And this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, John Russell, and Alice Bryant. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
For the first time, a group of the world's top oil companies have set goals to cut carbon gas emissions as a percentage of their total production. Among the businesses agreeing to the effort were Saudi Aramco, China's CNPC, and the American company ExxonMobil. The targets are the idea of an industry-led group called the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative, or OGCI. Its 12 member companies are responsible for over 30% of the world's oil and gas production. The goals are based on what the OGCI members call upstream carbon intensity. The target represents a reduction in production of between 36 and 52 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent by 2025, the OGCI said in a press release. The organization estimates the reduction would be equal to the carbon dioxide emissions resulting from energy use in 4 to 6 million homes. The intensity targets mean that total carbon emissions can still rise as production increases. OGCI's chairman is Bob Dudley, a former chief of the London-based oil and gas company, BP. He told Reuters news agency that while the agreement represents an important milestone, it does not represent the end of efforts to reduce emission levels. "We'll keep calibrating as we go forward," Dudley added. The agreement came after the OGCI's European members individually announced plans for even deeper cuts. Among the companies setting those targets were BP, Royal Dutch Shell, and Total. The OGCI members agreed on a common methodology to measure carbon intensity. Dudley said the targets could be extended in the future to other areas, such as liquefied natural gas and refining operations. London-based research group Carbon Tracker dismissed the OGCI's claims that the targets met those of the 2015 Paris Agreement to limit global warming. Carbon Tracker's Andrew Grant said in a statement that having some targets to reduce carbon pollution is better than none. But he added that the oil and gas industry can never be aligned with the Paris goals when the industry plans include continuous investment in fossil fuel production. The announcement marks a major change for ExxonMobil, the largest oil company in the United States. Exxon has resisted pressure from investors to be more open about the environmental effects of its products. The company has yet to report its carbon emissions for 2019. A spokesman for Exxon said it supports the OGCI targets and is part of the industry's efforts to take practical, meaningful steps to reduce emissions. The goals set by individual companies can differ widely in definition and structure, making comparisons difficult. But the targets of some individual OGCI members are already higher than those set in the new agreement. OGCI said the group's collective carbon intensity would be reported once a year, and the data would be examined by an independent group. I'm Brian Lynn.
A European and NASA spacecraft has sent back the closest pictures ever taken of the sun's surface. They show the surface has thousands of small solar flares, or what scientists are calling campfires. Scientists released the first images taken by Solar Orbiter last week. The spacecraft was launched from Cape Canaveral, Florida, in February. The orbiter was around 77 million kilometers away from the sun, about halfway between Earth and the sun, when it took the pictures. Solar Orbiter's pictures are the first images from so close to the sun's surface. They show colored swirls, bright yellow and dark gray. Daniel Mueller is a European Space Agency project scientist. He told the Associated Press, or AP, that the research team had to create a new term for the small flares, campfires. Mueller described the many campfires as quite possibly the tiny cousins of the solar flares that we already know. These small flares could help explain why the sun's outer covering, the corona, is 300 times hotter than the star's surface. But scientists are waiting for more information from Solar Orbiter's other instruments to know for sure. David Bergmans is with the Royal Observatory of Belgium. He was the lead scientist who developed the instrument that took the images. Bergmans told the AP that, "When the first images came in, my first thought was, 'This is not possible. It can't be that good.'" He added, "It was really much better than we expected, but what we dared to hope for." The $1.5 billion spacecraft will move even closer to the sun's surface in the next 2 years. The spacecraft will change its orbit as the mission goes on. This will make it possible for Solar Orbiter to take the first pictures of the solar poles. Solar Orbiter also carries plasma sampling instruments to offer researchers additional information about the sun. Project scientist Holly Gilbert notes, "That combination really allows us to make links and connections to what's happening on the sun and what's happening at the spacecraft." Gilbert is with NASA, the U.S. government's civilian space program. Solar Orbiter's main mission of examining the sun's polar areas will help researchers understand the causes of solar wind, electrically charged particles that go through our solar system. Solar wind can affect satellites and electronics on Earth. This is just the beginning of the long epic journey of solar orbiter, Mueller said. I'm John Russell.
For generations, school has been a place for children to learn and make friends. But in the United States, school is important to many parents for another reason. It is a safe place that cares for their children while they are working, or a necessity for them to be able to work at all. The spread of the coronavirus this year and the resulting changes have caused these ideas of school and American life to collide. Now, President Donald Trump is demanding that schools reopen in a few weeks. But with virus infection rates rising, many working parents see no good options. Michelle Brinson lives in Nashville, Tennessee. She works full-time for a nonprofit group while raising her 11-year-old child alone. She told the Associated Press she does not have the option of a husband or other family member to care for her son. At age 50 and with health conditions, Brinson says she is terrified of getting infected with the coronavirus. She is worried that if her son goes back to school, he could bring the virus home to her. If I'm dead or connected to breathing equipment, she says, what good am I to him? This is not the first time American schools have closed or talked about it because of an epidemic. It happened in 1918 with an influenza pandemic, and in the 1930s and 1950s, when polio was a major health issue. But the nature of school has changed completely since the 1950s, notes education historian Jonathan Zimmerman. School used to teach basic skills and citizenship, but extensive schooling was not needed for many jobs. The whole structure of the economy changed after World War II, and schooling became a necessity for personal independence like it never had before, he explained. In a way, schools have also become like social service agencies. They provide necessities like meals and mental health services. That is where the conflict comes in. Asking a parent to work full-time while supervising schooling and daytime meals can lead to stress and impossible expectations. That is especially true for a parent trying to raise a child alone. Rebecca Witt offers evidence of that. For Witt, the experience of working from home while helping her two young children finish the school year from home is not one she wants to repeat. Witt works as a spokeswoman for the Kansas Department of Corrections. During a coronavirus outbreak that infected more than 900 prisoners, she remembers her children coming into the room and shouting one day while she was being interviewed. Her husband, the head of a school, shared the homeschooling responsibilities, but was also busy helping teachers at his school move to online learning. Trying to work, it was hard, Rebecca Witt said. She is waiting to see what the plan is for the new school year and is hopeful they won't be home full-time with me trying to teach and work. Before the virus, Michelle Brinson says she went to her workplace every day and her son went to school and then went to after-school programs daily. Brinson was totally unprepared when schools closed in March. So she took several days off until she got permission to work from home. Now her employer is pushing her to come back to the office. Yet in many ways, Brinson and Witt are lucky. Their jobs offer at least some room for compromise. Taryn Walker has been depending on her two teenage children to care for her 5-year-old child while she works as an office assistant. Her offices never closed, and she is not permitted to work from home. The situation has also hurt Walker financially as her food costs rise. Because they are home all day, I'm paying 2 or 3 times the amount I did before, she says. But Walker also does not feel safe sending the children back to school. Elizabeth Ananot is an economics professor at Barnard College in New York City. She served as an economic advisor to Barack Obama during his presidency. She has been surveying a group of 1,000 hourly service workers for almost a year. Ananot told the AP she has found that working families with young children have been especially harmed by the health crisis. Parents need to work to pay for food, but also need to care for their children. And they cannot risk getting sick. Those issues existed before, but the lack of school and other childcare programs and the deadly nature of the virus are adding to the pressures. Ananot calls the situation a disaster. She says federal aid for businesses and the unemployed has helped, but not everyone who was eligible was able to get it. But now much of that money is running out, she notes. And businesses are pressuring parents to return to the workplace while school systems do not have a plan to make that happen, Ananot says. In Florida and Texas, 2 states with rising infection rates, officials are requiring school districts to offer in-person schooling to those who want it. I'm Alice Bryant.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Woodrow Wilson. He served 2 terms, from 1913 to 1921, and led the United States through the First World War. Wilson might have seemed an unlikely war president. He was a university professor before he entered politics. And when the conflict began in Europe in 1914, Wilson strongly rejected the idea of the U.S. getting involved. He even campaigned for his 2nd term on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." But Wilson's idealism eventually made him believe the U.S. must enter the conflict. He famously said, "The world must be safe for democracy." He spent the last months of his presidency fighting to create a League of Nations that would prevent future wars. Wilson did not succeed in that effort, but the effects of his presidency are still seen today in both the domestic and foreign affairs of the United States. Woodrow Wilson was born in the state of Virginia in 1856 and grew up in the South. Wilson's father was a Protestant Christian minister who supported the views of the Confederacy during the Civil War. Wilson's mother had been born in England, but raised in the United States. She was reportedly warm and loving, especially to her husband and four children. Wilson's early life was marked by poor health and a passion for learning. His education included tutoring by Confederate soldiers, classes with his father, a year at Davidson College, a bachelor's degree from the school now called Princeton, 1 year of law school, and a doctoral degree in history and political science from the University of Johns Hopkins. He remains, so far, the only president with a Ph.D. Wilson's academic interests were in government and how it could be most effective. Even as a young man, he supported the idea of a strong executive, either a prime minister or a president. He wrote a number of books, including a biography of George Washington and a history of the United States. He also taught popular classes at several colleges, including Bryn Mawr in Pennsylvania, Wesleyan in Connecticut, and Princeton in New Jersey. In time, Wilson became the president of Princeton. He made major reforms to the school until some faculty and alumni resisted his efforts. Wilson had always been interested in political power. The Democratic Party in New Jersey became interested in Wilson when they were looking for a candidate with an honest public image. In truth, party officials believed he would be a weak leader whom they could influence. Wilson surprised them by winning the seat as New Jersey governor easily and then rejecting their efforts to control him. He went on to pass major reform legislation in New Jersey that reduced corruption and protected the rights of workers. His actions drew the attention of Democratic Party leaders seeking a candidate for president in 1912. Voters did not overwhelmingly choose Wilson in 1912. Although he did well in the Electoral College, he earned only a little more than 40% of the popular vote. Other votes were mostly divided between two former presidents, Theodore Roosevelt and William Taft. Yet, Wilson quickly asserted authority over Congress and pushed through a number of laws aimed at dramatic reform. Historian Kendrick Clements at the University of South Carolina says, Wilson had a strongly progressive vision. He was interested in expanding economic opportunity for people at the bottom of society and eliminating special privileges enjoyed by the richest and most powerful members of society. One of Wilson's most important acts was to create a new federal agency called the Federal Reserve Board. It still regulates American banks, credit, and money supply. He also created the Federal Trade Commission to ensure fair business practices and the Department of Labor to protect workers' rights. And he supported laws to reduce working hours for railroad employees, bar child labor, and offer government loans to farmers. But even during Wilson's busy lawmaking, the threat of world war demanded his attention. Wilson had declared that the U.S. would remain neutral in the growing conflict between the Allied and Central Powers. One of his reasons was that people in the U.S. were immigrants from the countries that were at war. Wilson did not want the conflict to divide Americans. However, he permitted international trade, including with Britain and France. As a result, many believed the U.S. was favoring those countries. In 1915, a German submarine sank a British ship called the Lusitania and killed more than 100 Americans on board. Wilson protested several times to Germany about the sinking. He warned that the U.S. would not accept another such aggression. But 2 years later, Germany attacked U.S. commercial ships. It also invited Mexico to enter into an alliance against the United States. At the beginning of Wilson's second term in office, he asked Congress to declare war on Germany. The U.S. entered World War I on the side of the Allied powers. The additional support came at an important time. American soldiers were able to help resist German troops in France. In time, Germany asked for an armistice, an agreement to stop fighting. Following the war, Wilson had a grand vision for how to gain lasting peace in Europe. He proposed that the countries that had won the war not punish Germany. Wilson also wanted European colonies to rule themselves and other areas be given immediate independence. Most importantly, Wilson suggested a League of Nations that would guarantee the member countries independence and safety. But few world leaders agreed with his plan completely. Even in the U.S., many Republican lawmakers in Congress resisted Wilson's idea for a League of Nations. Some strongly objected to any treaty that would limit the country's independence. Others did not want the country to be involved in world issues at all. So Wilson began a trip across the U.S. to raise public support for the League of Nations. He traveled more than 15,000 kilometers in 22 days and gave 29 speeches. Wilson's doctors warned him that the trip was hard on his health, but Wilson was firm about pressuring Senate Republicans to adopt the agreement. Finally, he collapsed from exhaustion. Shortly after, he suffered a major stroke. Although he recovered somewhat, he remained partly paralyzed. He rarely appeared in public again. Instead, Wilson communicated to Congress through his wife. When Republicans changed the treaty to deal with their concerns, Wilson told his supporters to reject it. In the end, the U.S. never did join the League of Nations. When a new president, Warren Harding, was sworn in 1921, Edith and Woodrow Wilson retired to a house in Washington, D.C. 3 years later, the former president died quietly there, finally at peace. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.